Having written over a dozen books of poetry and essays and translations, Rachel Haddis is what we call a scholar poet, the kind we rarely see anymore. But while the term scholar poet might make us think of the academic world or the relentlessly literary world or the theoretical world, Rachel Haddis's poems are informed by this world, the domestic workaday world of ID photos and bathing one's small child. And with such loving, sensual detail of the world around us, sight and sound and touch, along with gently chiming slant rhymes and usually, but not always, iambic pentameter, she transforms the everyday into stately explanations of the commonplace. As James Merrill wrote of her first book, Rachel Haddis's honeyed words and bracing forms over and over bring the mind to its senses. Her poems are rooted in the domestic, but as a scholar, they are also illuminated by a lifelong engagement in the classics. As Grace Shulman said of Halfway Down the Hall, Rachel Haddis's new and selected poems, antiquity illuminates the present. But the present also illuminates the classics, and in so many of her poems we encounter contemporary retellings and explanations of the river of forgetfulness, of River Styx, perhaps. Of a Greek chorus, of Hermes, Cassandra, and all the motley characters from Homer that she occasionally gives an extreme makeover to. Finally, these are the poems of not just a poetry teacher, but a poet who doesn't ask students the difference between poetry and prose as a rhetorical question. Rather, she quotes Philip Larkin and worries over the difference herself as she worries over the loss of self and ponders self-made public. These are the poems of a teacher who tastes metonymy and synecdoche on her tongue. The poems we are about to hear this evening are the poems of a woman who parses out the vehicle and tenor in her everyday life and, as a teacher, asks us to do the same, and ultimately asks us why it is we keep coming back to poetry again and again, as we have ever since, even before Homer. Rachel Haddis's most recent publications include The River of Forgetfulness, Laws, Indelible, and Halfway Down the Hall, New and Selected Poems. Since 1981, she has taught in the English department of the Newark, New Jersey campus of Rutgers University and teaches courses in literature and writing at both Columbia and Princeton, and is currently a Board of Governors Professor of English. Among her honors are a Guggenheim Fellowship, an Ingram Merrill Foundation grant, and an award in literature from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. We are both pleased and proud to welcome up to this podium Rachel Haddis.
Thank you, Richard. It's nice to be here. Nice to read after our musician. I'm not going to play anything. And I can never remember the difference between a tenor and a vehicle. It's like HDL and LDL cholesterol. I get confused. And I think the domestic poems that Richard mentioned belong to some other Rachel Haddis. My son is now 25 and in Nepal. I will try to connect with some of the nice things Richard said. I'm going to read three poems from The River of Forgetfulness, which indeed does kind of refer to the River Styx, but I'm not going to read one of the river poems. I'm going to start with a poem for women over 50, of whom there might be one or two in this room. And this is called The Gift. Women in their 50s are the recipients of an equivocal gift. Not yet conspicuous for being decrepit, we're evidently more than old enough to turn transparent. And this new cloaked state enables us to hear astonishing news from friends, acquaintances, and sometimes strangers, all of whom do not so much look at as through us, lean in, then gaze out over our shoulders in search of something unseen, unseeable. Why am I telling you this, I more and more am asked? Because I'm here and am invisible. At just the moment life draws one concealing curtain, though, another veil is being lifted. Youth's haze disperses, and I see distinctly through the one-way mirror of the years. I remember in one of Germaine Greer's later books, I think it was about menopause, she just couldn't get over the fact that she was in Italy, and she said, "We beckoned to the waiter, but he seemed not to see us." No, get used to it, Germaine. Invisibility lets you do some nice things. I was talking at noon today at UMSL about Sappho and reading a poem in sapphics, and this is another one, but I don't think Sappho ever wrote a poem called The Nosebleed. And it's set in southern Vermont, only because I mentioned the word Bennington. And when I taught this poem in a class at Rutgers Newark for a colleague in whose classes I like to give a talk every semester, he explained to our students, he said, "Bennington's a place where there are a lot of blonde people," because blondness turns up in the first stanza, too. It was a very exotic place for our students at Rutgers. And, of course, the fourth line in each stanzaic quatrain goes da-da-da-da-da, as I explained this noon, like blueberry pancakes. The nosebleed. Waiting for a Bennington light to change, I saw last week a girl lean against a woman, both blonde, standing outside a supermarket. Mother, bent over, asked some question. All this I saw, heard nothing. Before the light turned, I had divined the problem. When she lifted her face to her mother, bingo, it was a nosebleed. "It's still bleeding a little," the daughter answered as we drove away. And I know the mother bent again to offer the child a second Kleenex and kiss her. Green light, green hills, we're driving north, it's summer. Law enacted fleetingly in a rearview mirror, no less powerful for its local interpretation. Love as rocking cradle that two can rest in, bodies nested, cupped in one curve of shelter. Question, answer, need met as it arises. Trouble breeds comfort. And obviously trouble doesn't always breed comfort, and nosebleeds don't always get mopped up. But when the feedback loop of motherhood or any loving relationship is working, it's so effortless that you forget it's actually a sort of a dialectical process. And this was all seen sort of through the rearview window. One of my connections with St. Louis, as some of you know, is my half-brother David Haddis, who taught at Washington U for many years and died. It's going to be 5 years in March, which is incredible, right? And this is a poem about standing outside a classroom at Rutgers, where I teach, not too many hours after I learned about David's death, and sort of standing there with my hand on the door. And it begins by referring to some poems that David and I had talked about on the phone not too long before. It's a true poem, and I wanted to pay tribute to this really ugly building where I've taught a lot of classes, so I have the name of the classroom, the number. And I also think many, many poets are English teachers, and many English teachers write poetry, but often they kind of cut the students out of the poem, like slicing somebody out of a photograph. It's very hard to get the text and the teacher and the students into the poem, and I sometimes try to do that a little bit. Conklin, 4:55, 3:55 p.m., Wednesday, March 3rd, 2004. Hardy's kneeling oxen, Merrill's sword dangling death over the youth in bed, Frost's lover hankering for a counter word, Ransom's white geese that cried in goose, alas. You poems we read my brother in those last phone calls, so that instead of silences, the valedictory music of each phrase filled his weeks and days. Help me today, please. Come with me to class. Up two flights to Conklin Hall, fourth floor. Pause, door is closed. Regroup, it's 5 to 4. Remember who is waiting for me there. David, who died 12 hours ago, is part of me, and I am part of you. Serene, Muhammad, Gladys, Osner, Chad. I offer you no more than what I've had lavished on me. Love what you give away. Aha, you get to keep it till you die. The keeping is synonymous with giving. My brother gave as long as he was living, and longer after more. I open the door. Oh, thank you. And now for something completely different. I mentioned again at noon, and I'll keep this short if I can, that I'm co-editing what I call the big slow anthology of Greek poetry and translation from Homer to the present. It should come out before 2010 with any luck, but don't hold your breath. And this is a poem I actually translated for it. I was more responsible for the ancient piece of the anthology with, I have three co-editors, wonderful co-editors. But this is a poem I translated from a poet called Dionysios Solomos, whose dates are 1798 to 1857, which, for those of you who know much about English literature or even a little, would make him kind of contemporary with someone like Keats, the younger generation of romantics. He was the son of an Italian nobleman and a Greek peasant, and he grew up on one of the Ionian islands, the islands to the west of Greece, like Corfu. And his decision to write in Greek was kind of a political decision because educated people at that time and place went to Italian universities. And my history isn't very good, but there were British soldiers stationed in the Ionian Islands at that time. Can anybody tell me why? It wasn't part of the British Empire, but they were hanging out there anyway. Getting ready? Right, well, right, something like that. It's interesting to think about the cultural background. This poem, then, was written in Greek, and if it's translated into blank verse, as it usually is on the rare occasions when it's translated at all, it sounds like Wordsworth on a really weird day, Wordsworth on speed or something. But it's written in a meter, which is 15 syllables per line, which goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which Wordsworth certainly is not. And it's sort of a folk poetry meter. And it's written because, as still happens on beautiful Greek islands, a young English soldier had been inspired by the moonlight and probably some wine he had drunk and had gone skinny dipping and had the bad luck to run into a shark in the Ionian Sea, which ate him. And so this would have gone into the local paper, and Solomos wrote a poem called The Shark, commemorating this event and sort of apologizing on behalf of the Greeks. But the poem also has a lot of romantic coloring and a distinctly homoerotic tinge, which makes it altogether a very odd poem. And to make it even odder, it begins as the, I think, slightly tipsy, moonstruck soldier is speaking to his mother in his mind. He would be text messaging her now, you know, "Mom, it's beautiful here, the moon is shining." And then it switches to the third person as he fatefully walks into the water. So it's an altogether curious poem, but having talked about it for too long, I'll just read it. And again, Solomos was really one of the national poets of Greece. He wrote the national anthem of Greece, and he wrote some poems about the Greek War of Independence against the Turks. The Shark. Here comes the bird with golden wings. Again, it flies this way. It leaves the branch abruptly for the seashore and the rocks. It senses there the beauty of the ocean and the sky, and there pours forth its song with all its magic and its might. Sweetly it binds the sea up with the rocky wilderness, although it is not yet the hour for stars to venture forth. Thousands of stars, please send, O night, to bathe along with me. O bird, O little bird, who sing with all your might and main, if there's no blessed fortune in your marvel of a voice, then nothing good has blossomed on the earth or in the heavens. He's actually talking to the bird, I guess, not his mother, sorry. But I never hoped that life could be so powerful, so joyous. Alas, if only I could skim along as swift as lightning with you, dear sea foam, holding up and waiting to surround me, and come back with my mother's kiss and of my earth a handful. And switching to the third person. And all of nature smiled at him and yielded up her essence. Hope, you embraced him, speaking to him softly as a lover, and tightly bound his mind around with all your magic might. new world of beauty everywhere and joy and utter goodness. And now, if I had music, I'd say, here comes Jaws. Then his eyes encounter it, the monster of the deep. Far out of reach his sword, alas, far out of reach his rifle. There before the young man looms the tiger of the sea. But as it splits the waters easily and now emerges just at the young man's snow-white throat that gleams as bright as swan's down, at the broad chest and golden hair, the youth, that very moment strenuously having freed himself from nature's tight embraces, which had so sweetly murmured to him, sweetly bound him up, instantly unites in his one shining naked body the sleek art of the swimmer and the surge and shock of battle. Before his great soul breathed its last, joy filled him to the brim. As in a flash of lightning, the youth came to know himself. And then just a final little sort of epitaph. Wonderful relic, all that's left us of deserted greatness, beautiful stranger cut off in the blossom of your youth, come, come ashore, receive the tribute of a strong man's tears. It's an odd poem, and nowadays shark eatings would be more likely to be in the National Enquirer, but as my sister said to me, sharks are always news. They're in some way. They're archetypal. The next two poems, this one, Wedding, and the one that follows, Body of Book. Wedding is going to be up on Slate in November, and Body of Book was on Slate last winter and is still archived there. And I think that the aesthetic at Slate, as far as my poetry, is something sort of archetypal and odd and not necessarily easy to follow. This is called Wedding. If rings exchanged do signify a wedding, or a couple standing face to face making a promise, then it was a wedding, I dreamed, all draped with garlands of green meaning. August, meanwhile, was reeking with black smoke. Day's broadcast or night's scenario, which message was either message true? Confusedly through sleep, I recognized my bridal pair. But at the same time, something pressed against the haven of the night. Sheet lightning? The air trembled as if hoofs thundering a nightmare galloped past the house along the empty road. Summer was waning. I was getting old. The vision of the wedding fell away and launched me weary into a red morning. The world was warring, drowning, catching fire. And this poem, Body of Book, is two stanzas, and the second stanza, with the exception of one line, simply recycles lines that have appeared in the first stanza. A colleague said to me, I see this is a green poem. You're recycling your lines. And I like to tell students that repetition is a fantastically powerful tool in poetry. It's also a nice economic tool. You don't have to make up as many new lines. And I think that people attribute an importance to repetition which it doesn't necessarily merit. And it's certainly about three things that mean a lot to me, reading and sleep and the whole idea, the way they join, the idea of horizontality, because I'm somebody who likes to read when I'm lying down, for example. Body of Book. This is one way to talk about a book. I woke into the locus of my body. In sleep's thick envelope, what poems fit? Dream card sealed with a kiss and then sent out where what we meant was musing, nothing else. Did the dream not spring from memory? Remembering who said what or what I read, the sin of middle age, misattribution. Cherished, it writes itself upon your skin. I could tell the time of day without looking at the sun. Salted with a tear and wiped and sent, you take it with you to the land of sleep, body of book to read and to be read to, out into the world, its face still damp. Cherished, it writes itself upon your skin. You take it with you to the land of sleep. Remembering who said what or what I read, I could tell the time of day without looking at the sun. Body of book to read and to be read to, salted with a tear and wiped and sent, the sin of middle age, misattribution, out into the world, its face still damp, dream card sealed with a kiss, and then sent out until we all went wearily to bed. I woke into the locus of my body, where what we meant was kindness, nothing else. Did the dream not spring from memory? This is one way to talk about a book. This is one of those sort of simile poems Richard mentioned, though shorter than many others. I like snakes, and I like to write about snakes, though they creep me out a little bit too. And in that, I'm like Virgil and plenty of other poets, though I don't write that well about snakes. Ends of summer, time in the country, time before departures. Time tapers to a snake that slides invisibly off into the long grass of the world, though such a narrowed notion fails to scratch the itch lodged in between, impatiently waiting for something new to happen, and clinging to what having already happened slithers off into the brush without a sound. A couple of summers ago, my son and I went to snakes on a plane. That was an experience. A really terrible movie. But the guide to snakes, the equivalent to the Roger Torrey Peterson Bird Book, was open on the table because I'd seen a remarkable snake on the road not long before. So seeing all these coiled shapes in the book and then in the movie was almost too much for me. This is a poem about the Georgia O'Keeffe Archive, which my sister, who is here, took me to in Santa Fe last January. And it's also about looking at some of the archive, you could say, of my husband, who is ill and no longer living at home. And it's called In the Drawer. I can only bear to go through your old letters glancingly at first. Tucked away in my own files, they were half forgotten and half lost. Georgia O'Keeffe's blue sneakers, navy blazer, and white silk handkerchief turn out to have been reverently preserved in Santa Fe in cabinets. My sister took me there today. Whose shallow drawers contain, with other treasures, paint chips like little shards of desert sky, brushes, pastels. Open another, stones which she collected, cherished. Another, bones, vertebrae especially, and skulls small enough to fit into these long, low drawers. Another, rows of pink and pearly shells. A reliquary of the whole outdoors, of desert seasons shrunk and tucked away in shallow trays that shut without a sound and open only at some scholar's sesame. Such objects, if they can be said to speak, employ a different dialect from the bright gloss of colors stroked across a canvas, affably beckoning from some neutral wall, so that the viewer peers into it as into a mirror that can tell whatever it is we ask reflections to convey. Bones and shells and stones, though, keep their counsel. As to what your letters to me say, I cannot yet quite bear to look and see. I do note shared jokes, references, joy, when I snatch a glance quickly from the corner of my eye. And I think just three more, and two of the three are also arising from this illness, I've had many conversations about this, but just to put it briefly, when somebody has a neurodegenerative disease and sort of slowly ceases being able to act like their old selves, it's very, very lonely living with them. And this is a villanelle called The Boat. But it's also an example of how extremely helpful figurative language is when you're dealing with something as inchoate and indefinable as a psychiatric, psychological, or neurodegenerative condition. There's simply no way of describing it except by comparing itself to something, it to something else. So this is a short-lined villanelle called The Boat. We were talking about villanelles at lunch, and I was saying to Nan, I find them easier than sonnets these days. The Boat. All day I bustle in and out while you're at home. No, far away. All night we sail in the same boat. I think of trying to invite friends whom we no longer see. All day I'm busy, in and out. For you, the hours accumulate or fly by, maybe. Don't ask me. At night we sail in the same boat. The ties that bind have grown too tight. Entangled, you sit peacefully. I squirm and struggle to get out. Angry, impatient, or contrite, I stir the pot of poetry. At night, we idle in our boat. To lose a self without a fight, you barely have a word to say. My mind's revolving in and out. Nights, we sail blindly in our boat. And this is another from sort of the same series, I guess, called The Beam, which almost reads like an attempt to anatomize something. I was never any good at math, but it's sort of as if I'm struggling with some rather simple equation, which simply won't come out right. The Beam. What I have to give you, you don't want or cannot any longer recognize. What you still seem to want or need, I give grudgingly, then less and less, then not. What I need, you no longer can give me, and both of us are angry. So I turn away and have for years, though rooted to the spot, been turning like a beam, a searchlight, hopefully or doggedly, from sheer habit, raking the gloom. I don't know if that's a tenor or a vehicle. And this is the last poem. And the end of it, the phrase at the end of the poem is, I think, the title of the manuscript I'm just about finishing now, and that's called The Ache of Appetite. And this is home remedy. And again, I'm working with similes and metaphors. There are so many different kinds of poetry. Another way to put this is it's very hard to define poetry, but if you're in the business of teaching poetry or judging it, it helps to have some model in your mind of what a poem is or does, and yet it's very limiting to have one model, as I'm sure Carl would agree, for example. So this is a little exercise in thinking about the different ways you can think about poems. Home remedy. A poem need not be a diary, entry, or letter, dream report, or shred of the observations of a day, nor thumbnail answer to what someone said. It needn't be a massive rusted arc of sculpture. It can be one polished stone, luminous as a cat's eye in the dark, compact as a tiny ivory pawn. Axe to the frozen sea, said Kafka, or a formulation of Northrop Frye's myth cross-sectioned yields up metaphor. If life's a loaf, a poem is a slice. Not a cooked dish, let alone a full meal. Not even one ripe, glowing piece of fruit. More like a scribbled recipe to tell future strangers the approximate ingredients that hungry in your time you put together. Cook, eat, read, and write. Think of a poem, finally, as a home remedy for the ache of appetite. Thank you.